Today's episode of Robin's Podcast is sponsored by Simply Safe. As a dad, you think about all the different things you do to try to keep your family safe. In addition to that, I'm also responsible for any bugs that we find in the house and removing them safely because my kids ask a lot of questions about what happens to the bug after they stop moving. So I just take them in a cup and I bring them outside. But in addition to that, I keep them safe with Simply Safe because each Simply Safe system is a security arsenal expertly engineered to protect your home, not just from these lying survivors that we're going to talk about today. You can set up the system yourself in under an hour. There's no drilling or hardware required. You save hundreds on the installation fees. Simply Safe has a super fast wireless connection to authorities and a police dispatch with 24/7 alarm monitoring, and it is just $14.99 a month. No hidden fees, no annoying gotchas. That's it. No long-term contracts either. Simply Safe will never lock you in like other alarm companies do. Feel free to cancel anytime. You could also get a 60-day risk-free trial to try out the system in your home and see if you like it. We've been using Simply Safe for a couple of years, and we recommend it. Right now, go to simplysafe.com/dad now. If you order online today, get an extra 10% off, plus a free keychain remote and free shipping. That's at Simply Safe, SimpliSafe.com/dad. Hey, everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino back with another one of our Survivor off-season podcasts. And I think we got a fun one today because we are going to be talking about something that we all love, at least in terms of Survivor. We like to see the deception, the chicanery. We're going to be talking about the lies that Survivor players tell, specifically the 8 different types of lies that Survivor players are putting out there. Some are good liars, some are bad liars, but we're going to talk about that with a longtime listener who pitched me on this idea, and I said, I love it. Please welcome Stephen Callahan. Stephen, how are you?
I'm good, Rob. How are you?
Very good. And Stephen, I'm sure people are immediately jumping on your accent. So where are you from?
I'm originally from the Republic of Ireland, specifically from the Southwest, in a tiny little place called Clare.
Okay, good. So we have our international audience jumping in this off season. Could you tell us a little bit about how somebody from Ireland ended up getting into a crazy American reality show like Survivor?
It's crazy. I mean, where I'm from, we have like 4 channels that we can watch TV on if you don't have cable, so to speak. And so the channel that I found Survivor on is an Irish broadcasted channel. So they distribute everything in Irish, but they import a lot of American shows for cheap. So it's kind of like, you know, English learning, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we already can speak English, but we're kind of lucky that we get to see the likes of, you know, The OC, Survivor, and Nip Tuck back in the day. But yeah, I found Survivor completely by accident. I was tipping away through each of the channels, and I came across, you know, a lot of these people jumping out of a boat. And then I heard Jeff Probst saying 39 days, 16 people, only one survivor. And I was like immediately hooked. And that season was the Survivor Marquesas. And been a fan since then.
Okay. And they have continued to run all of the American Survivor on Irish television, or have you got to go on the internet and all sorts of underhanded ways to find the other season?
Yeah. So the thing is with that specific channel, it's kind of like on a 2 or 3 season delay. So mm-hmm. Let's say, for instance, Game Changers has just happened, but we're probably only seeing like Second Chances.
I won't spoil it for you.
You won't spoil it for me? Okay, good. Good. I'm really rooting for Vetus. sorry not to throw shade at Vetus. But yeah, unfortunately, yeah, I've had to be a little bit sneaky to keep up, so to speak.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's perfect for Second Chances, right?
Sneaky, sneaky!
Okay. So, Stephen, let's talk about the Survivor lies. This was a long while back. I think it was like towards the end of last year that you told me that you wanted to do this podcast. I'm glad that we finally got a chance to do it. So what is it about the lies of Survivor that made you want to try to catalog the types of lies Survivor players tell?
Yeah, it was an interesting aspect of the game that, you know, you see people lie on a daily basis in real life. And I felt like when it came to Survivor that lies specifically weren't getting their fair shot at being talked about. So I decided to go back season Borneo through Game Changers to see, you know, what lies can I uncover, and really categorize them and drill it down to 8 specific lies that survivors tell. Not to say that there's not more that I'm sure that people will be more than happy to let me know of after this podcast. But yeah, it's just a fascinating thing. It's storytelling in itself, lying. You know, it's just watching the human behavior at play, trying to get from point A to point B, and using whatever's in their toolbox to do that.
So you have categorized these 8 different lies, and I guess, do you want to just start talking us through the list, and we'll go through each one?
Yeah, absolutely. So number one is professions, really. When we look at people who come into Survivor pregame, we look at primarily what their professions are to try and get an indication of how they could potentially play the game. And more often than not, you'll see, even more in recency, that a lot of these survivors are starting to lie about their professions. And it's a case of identifying whether or not is it a sustainable way to progress through the game, or is it more of a hindrance than anything else?
Why do survivors lie about their profession? Is there mostly one reason?
Yeah, I mean, I drilled it down to 2 specific reasons. And primarily, as you know, just going back to the whole law enforcement thing, you have cops, you have lawyers. They're really the main ones who lie about their professions. And secondary to that are people in the public eye, like athletes or television stars, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And really what it is, it's identifying, you know, why are they lying? You know, you look across the board at instances like, let's say, you know, Jeff Kent from Survivor Philippines. He lies about being a rancher. I think he's from like Missouri or something. It fascinates me when people in the public eye specifically lie, because don't they know that people have Google, especially in America, where, you know, sports is quite a highly regarded thing.
Well, they don't have a smartphone on the island.
But I mean, you look at Cliff Robinson, Scott Pollard, all of these guys who were like 6-7 feet tall, and you know, you're going to have certain kind of impression of them. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me that they would, you know, decide to lie. Now, Scott didn't lie, but we'll get to that later on. But yeah, going back to the Tonys and the Bretts of the world, who lie about being cops. Really, it's more of a self-preservation thing, because, you know, cops aren't really liked for the most part. They're seen as threatening, overly strategical, and really can be seen as kind of sneaky, mm-hmm. especially in the game. And it's really just their way of adapting without trying to be exposed, so to speak.
So you have people who have sort of some sort of a background that people would think is intimidating, whether it's that they have money or they're in some sort of a profession like being a police officer. Do we ever see people who lie about what they do but end up putting themselves into a better position? Like, is there somebody who's like a pizza delivery guy but tells people that they are some sort of like actually like a more important job? Not to disparage any of our pizza delivery technicians in the audience.
Off the top of my head, not that I recall, because it's kind of going against the grain of that lie specifically.
I think that the only person I could think of might be Russell in Samoa, who was telling people about everything that he was doing. And it ended up being a bad thing, where people from Foa Foa were trying to say like, hey, he's got all this money. Don't give him a vote in the end.
Yeah, I think originally what Russell was trying to do was gain sympathy on Fofo in the early days with, you know, talking about being through Hurricane Katrina, losing his dog. And then, you know, Monica exposes him at the final 7 before she gets clipped. Probably, you know, he's probably the only fairest example of that. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, Russell didn't lose the game because of the fact that he had money, or so he says.
In terms of players that are lying about their background, that do you feel like, is this an effective strategy for Survivor players? Would you rate this as a lie that Survivor players should be using?
No, I definitely would not. And if I can, go into a bit more detail about Brett Lavelle specifically from Millennials versus Gen X. He comes into the game, states that he's going to lie about his profession, that he's not a cop. He's actually a funeral director. Well, this gets brought to fruition on the post-swap tribe of Ikabula with six tribe mates that he and five other tribe mates he ends up being with. And Hannah is really, drilling him like Zoe Barnes, House of Cards. But unfortunately for Brett, there's no train that he can throw her under. So,
spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Apologies about that. House of Cards, but post-swap on Ikabula, Hannah, starts asking him, what do you do again? And he's like, yeah, I'm a funeral director. I run the funerals. And just try to make the families as comfortable as possible, And Brett really kind of starts off in a kind of like a general sense. He's, sitting next to Sunday on a log and he's playing about with a twig or a stick. And he's actually picking it apart and licking it away. And he looks so disinterested in what Hannah is asking him. If someone is really passionate about what they do, whether it's a funeral director or, making pizza, they're going to, be a bit more engaged with the discussion going on. And, as the conversation progresses, she digs a little bit deeper. She asks, so do you like one family at a time, or how does it work? And he says, you make appointments and sit down and talk about, about the funeral and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he's not unlike James Miller, who relies on stuff, talking about his stuff. He says stuff three times throughout the interaction, and it's those kind of generic terms like stuff and things and those evasive type of words that he's using that kind of alienates the person that's asking the questions. And you kind of get the impression that, either he's lying about who he says he is, or he just doesn't want to talk about this job very much. Now, taking into account, it is day 20 and everyone's tired and hungry and, the total of the game is taking on them. But if that's your job, you should be a little bit more impassioned and have like 1,001 stories that you can rattle off like that,
Okay, now, Stephen, let me ask you about this because I don't want to get a bunch of angry tweets from Brett LaBelle because that we've talked about this with him. And he says he does have a lot of background into that. So what I want to ask your opinion on is if you end up in a situation like this, like Brett was in here with Hannah, like Tony ended up being in Cops R Us where Sarah was really grilling him, with Jeff Kent potentially, if Dawson ended up calling him out on what he's doing. Is there a point where if someone quizzes you on what you actually do and they're right, do you keep going with the lie? Is that the move to, at that point, when you're being called out, to say, you know what, okay, let me tell you what's really going on?
I think if you are, depending on how prepared you are with your lie pregame, as you mentioned, Brett had stories to tell, and I'm not, trying to say that he wasn't prepared or anything, but based on what you're seeing on the show, etc., that's what all you have to go on. But I think you still have to commit to it, and you still have to kind of, you maybe go on the offensive a little bit, maybe talk about one of your stories about work, and then kind of put it back on the other person and make them answer questions about themselves, and make them more involved in the conversation. And then if anything like that comes up again, you can kind of just do something similar. There's ways around it, I feel like, if you're going to commit to it and don't go back on it, because, I think that could jeopardize how people perceive you moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My gut says at that point to sort of come clean with it, but I think it really depends on what your actual job is, where it's exactly like a case of like Tony with Sarah, to come out and say, okay, you got me. I really am a police officer. That's cool that you are too. I just thought that people were going to get on my case. But, in the case of somebody who is a, famous athlete where, they've made all this money playing baseball, then I feel like that's pretty juicy gossip that's going to start getting around to people.
Yeah, I think with respect to Brett's position versus someone like Cliff from Kogayan or Jeff Kent or Gary Hogaboom or Hawkins or whatever he's going by now. With regards to them, where they are in the public eye and any one person can potentially expose them, then I think you should come clean. But with your position your profession as a cop, I think there is more room to maneuver.
Yeah. Now, do you feel like that this is something that is harder to pull off in a season like we're going to get this fall with the heroes and the hustlers and the healers, where it's like, oh, I'm on the healer tribe. Now I'm really painted in. I can't say that, you know, you have to like make up some other profession that's would also fit into, because you might come into the game and it's like, okay, well, I'm a brain surgeon, but I'm going to tell people that I drive a taco truck.
Yeah, I think it is when you are shoehorned into these types of categories like hustlers, healers, brains, bomb, beauties, etc. Mm-hmm. It's more difficult because you're limited in what lie you can tell about your profession. So I do think it would be harder. Like, yeah, as you mentioned, the brain surgeon, you're trying to play that down as something else, and it's not really going to fly, because why lie about being a brain surgeon if you're going to say, like, maybe you're an accountant? I mean, there's no sense in doing so. So yeah, I think it's going to be a lot harder and kind of unnecessary. I really look back to Survivor Code Wrong specifically in a pregame with Scott Pollard, as I mentioned earlier. He spoke about in his exit press with, I think it was Carla Matt, actually. And they asked him, why didn't you lie about your profession? And his response was, I figured they'd be like, he's a former wrestler, a football player, a basketball player. I just embraced it and went with it. And I feel like that's how all survivors should look at the specific life. It's such an intrinsic part of your life. You go to work on a day-to-day basis, 5, maybe 6 times, 7 times if you're crazy. You know, it's impossible to keep up that lie. And so I think from the offset, you know, just be honest. I mean, I know it's hard, especially when people are looking at you and have certain perceptions, because people are going to have those perceptions in the game, like Brett had with Hannah and Jay, who called him out while he was off the camp, saying that he was definitely a cop. And that was their perception. And that's what they believed during the course of the game. You know, you're putting an obstacle in front of you before the game is even begun, if that makes sense.
Right, because the game is really about winning people over and fostering these social bonds with people. And in a way, you think you're protecting yourself because you are going to hide what you really do, but you end up, because of that, being more guarded, and that reads as being shady at times. And so it's something that ultimately becomes another hurdle that you have to overcome.
Absolutely. And, you know, Survivor's going to create hurdles for you. Why create one for yourself?
All right. So we are thumbs down for the most part on survivors lying about their profession. Anything else on this first survivor lie?
You know, you say your thumbs down, but hey, if people want to keep doing it, it's great TV. If it blows up their game and they get sent home, you know, that's fun too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, going through this, the real first, you know, prominent lie about the profession was Gary Hogaboom in Guatemala, and that really kind of, you know, set the tone of thinking about, you know is it really worth the hassle about lying? You know,
well, forget about just the hassle that he's got to worry about Amy coming and beating him down. That, Gary Hawkins, I will find you, I will beat you down.
Yeah, exactly. You have people trying to murder you. That's the problem. Not to mention that, you know, Danny Boatwright randomly going to some sportscaster that knows you. You know, that really was, for me, the basis of how I looked at this particular one. It's only going to cause more hassle than it's worth.
All right, Stephen, let's talk about the second lie that Survivor players tell.
Right, this is going to be a big one, and it's the broken promise. The ones that we're going to look at for this is primarily the most biggest broken promise of all, Survivor All-Stars, Boston Rob and Lex, which we'll get into a moment. But broken promise itself is something that we see, you know, more than frequently on Survivor. Sometimes it's a big storyline, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it can be as little as not taking somebody on a reward when you promised them, like Ian did to Katie in Palau, and there's a whole like after-school special where she's like crying at him and he's crying at her, and it's a mess. Or it can be something big as like promising someone to go to the end with them on day two and cutting them a final four, like Ken does to David in Millennials versus Gen X.
Yeah.
But it's such a fascinating thing when you look at one party promises something to another, and it's whether or not they they're going to deliver.
Now, Stephen, I think that this is an interesting one because I would feel like that 95% of these start as truths, that somebody is making a pact with someone and it's not necessarily a lie because it was true when they said it, but they end up deciding that, no, I have a better option, or I've changed my mind. I don't want to do that anymore. But to the person who had that pact broken, it feels like a lie, but it's unusual because it is not something that was said as a falsehood.
Absolutely. I completely agree. These things start off as truths, but you know, things change in the game. Your options, they increase, and you see different paths getting to the end where necessarily the person you made an agreement with is not included in that scenario. And yeah, sometimes you do have to break those promises, and it's unfortunate for that first person because they don't understand necessarily why you've broken up that promise and screwed them over. But yeah, no, absolutely, 100% agree. They don't necessarily often start off as a straight out lie, but you know, as the game progresses, your options change and your desire to get to the end increases and, you know, takes over any sense of loyalty or promise that you've had to this person.
Yeah, it's tricky because in real life, I mean, this is why we have contracts where you make a deal with someone and then often it's legally binding where it's like, okay, if you go back on this pact that we settled, then there will be legal consequences. Whereas on these reality shows, you make a deal with someone, it's like, okay, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine first. And then there's very little to hold over that person's head once that you have scratched their back. And I think that Lex and Rob example that you cite is the ultimate example of this.
You know, your own day-to-day life, you might make an arrangement with a friend to meet in a bar on a Friday, and then it gets to Thursday night, and you're like, well, maybe I might just stay home and binge watch Orange is the New Black or something. Mm-hmm. And you didn't lie in the first instance, but your priorities have changed and you don't really want to meet them. And then you break that promise and your friend is a little bit upset, and but you know, they tend to get over it. But with Survivor, you know, the stakes are raised. This is a lot more than just a friendship on the line.
Yeah.
Moving on to Boston Rob and Lex specifically, we start off in Survivor All-Stars. Lex walks in. He's like, this is strictly business this time. You know, if you're my friend, Ethan, Colby, you're out. I'm doing this for me. But then we get to this pivotal moment at the final 10, post immunity challenge, where the new Mogo Mogo beat the new Shapira. So I think I got that right. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets very messy with all these flip-flops. And then, you know, there's a brief like hug interaction moment, which Jeff wakes up momentarily after, and it, you know, Boston Rob does the, you know, you take care of her, I'll take care of you kind of thing.
And the situation is that Rob and Lex were close friends going into that season. And Rob and Amber end up famously having this showmance on the island. And they ultimately did a tribe swap at this point in the game. And both teams ultimately ended up switching buffs, that everybody ended up back with the same people that they started with, just on the opposite tribe, with the exception of Amber, who ends up with Lex and Kathy and Jerry and Sheehan. And they have a golden opportunity to take away a number from the other side. They're going into the merge down in the numbers, but if they ended up getting rid of Amber, and then potentially Big Tom could have ended up flipping back over. So they had a chance if they ended up getting rid of Amber in that spot, but Rob makes this last second pitch to Lex before they walk away from the immunity challenge. Hey, you take care of her, I'll take care of you if you can.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the first time that friends and returning players have played together on Survivor. And it goes a lot more deeper than just 16, 18 strangers playing a game together. You know, there's relationships out of the game that have formed. And, you know, you can take what Lex says at the start of All-Stars at face value and call him a hypocrite. But, you know, it's an
easy
judgment
to pass. We won't do that today.
I don't think it is.
Yeah.
No, definitely not. Okay. You know, I like Lex. I really want to see him play again. But yeah, there's something really great that happens at the start of the merge. Boston Rob starts with a confessional, He says, you know, as soon as we merge, Lex comes running over to me. Rob, make me feel comfortable. Tell me that I'm safe. Tell me that I'm safe. And then it cuts to, you know, Rob and Lex walking. And he says, I will do everything I can. You got other friends in camp. So, dot, dot, dot. You know what I mean? And that should have been a red flag that Lex, he should have caught on at that point.
A Shapira red flag, yeah.
A Shapira red flag, exactly. And he didn't. I mean, Rob was specifically evading any sort of kind of like, he was separating himself almost. He was kind of distancing himself from any sort of like potential promise that he had to Lex. So that should have been something that Lex should have picked up on.
Oh, well, I definitely feel like that Lex was picking up that red flag. I think that he was not thrilled in confessional talking about how he really wanted Rob to put him at ease. And Rob was not putting him at ease at that point.
And we get to that later in the episode where him and Kathy are, you know, crestfallen post-immunity challenge. And, you know, he says there's something very telling about the fact that we've been here together at the merch for a whole day. And there's been absolutely, he hasn't lifted a finger to make us feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, unfortunately for Lex, you know, it is strictly business for Rob, and he's on the business end of that deal.
Well, they end up having this whole conversation, and we really do a deep dive into this in The Evolution of Strategy, where we end up like doing the whole thing like word for word. But yeah, Lex finds out for sure that deal has changed.
The word I gave you was that if I can take care of you, I will. I'm sorry, I cannot.
Yeah, he said that was only if he could, he would do it. He cannot.
If he could, yeah, exactly.
You got to read the fine print on that deal.
You do. It's like one of those Willy Wonka contracts when they walk in.
Yeah.
And it's that really big, huge, long contract where you can't even read half the writing.
Right.
You know, I feel so bad for Kathy in that moment.
Sure.
She's like,
they're both very upset.
Brutal, man.
Yeah, they're both like, you know, in tears. The only thing I really don't like about that, because I, you know, the game is the game, and you have to do what you have to do. The only thing I really don't love is that Rob in confessional ends up really saying to the audience, like, what? You didn't think I was really gonna do that, do you? And look, you lie to Lex, you lie to Kathy, you lie to me on the island, but don't lie to me when I'm watching the show at home.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't get it twisted.
Yeah, it really lets you know that Rob is the villain. He's there to play, he's there to dominate, and doesn't care who he starts with that.
Steven, is there a lie on your list that the lies Survivor players tell to the audience at home in confessional? Is that on the list?
No, it isn't. But the ninth lie? It should be. It can be. I think we'll add it to it.
Okay.
I think a lot of those people tell that type of lie.
And don't forget the 10th lie is the lie that Survivor players tell in their exit interviews about how they were about to win the game.
Exactly. You know, they're not canon as Steven Fishback says.
Right.
Even though we read them anyway and we're like trying to find clues as to what, you know, really went down, and, you know, revisionist history is what it is, I think, and on exit interviews. But yeah, you really have to take them at face value, really.
Steven, what's the takeaway here in terms of that if you're a Survivor player, like a promise isn't worth the tribal parchment that it's written on?
When it comes to promises, there really has to be a clear, they have to be almost transparent. I think short-term promises are probably the way to go. You know, and I know this is probably not the best example for particularly Adam Gentry in Survivor Cook Islands, but more so for Yule in the final seven, when Adam approaches Yule and he's like, well, if you get rid of Penner before me and Parvati, you've got my jury vote. And, you know, Yule sticks to that deal. And it's a short-term promise for Adam. He gets three more days on the island and he gets to send his, you know, nemesis, Jonathan Penner, out the door. But, you know, credits Yule in order to get his jury vote, and it does, and it helps him win the game. But yeah, I think short-term promises are the way to go, you know, and be clear and be specific on what you're promising somebody. Don't have too many nuances to it, like, you know, with Dreams and with Yao Man, where, you know, at the final six, I'll give you my truck. If that final four, you give me immunity, and, you know, it gives too much people wiggle room to renege and turn on you, and gives them more time to think about themselves, because we're selfish creatures at heart. We're you know, we're self-interested.
I do think a good way to look at this is, and this is an idea from How to Win Friends and Influence People, is this idea of the emotional bank account. And so that every time you sort of like do something nice for a person, you make a promise, you keep your word, you know, you're building that balance with people of, you know, I have so much trust in this person, so much trust in this person. And then ultimately, if you end up, you know, bouncing a check to that person or, you know, breaking your word, you know, that ends up being a deduction. And if you end up sort of like in the negative value with that person, that's when they're done dealing with you. It's, you know, it really is like a bank and you have this line of credit. And if you end up being in default to that person, that's when that nobody's going to end up trusting you. So you can ultimately, you know, break these promises to people, but I would advise, you know, build up that balance with people so that you still have room to end up smoothing things over after the fact.
You know, I absolutely agree. You are working with these people, you know, if you're working long-term specifically with some people 30 odd days into a game, you really do have to engender some sort of trust with them. And if you're going to be making promises, you have to kind of follow through on them for the most part. But, you know, don't follow through them to a detriment to your own game. But you really kind of have to walk that fine line.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Also, let me just fact check myself. I believe the emotional bank account is from the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. So I apologize about that.
That's okay. Well, you could have been
I was lying the first time. That was that's what I was doing.
Total blindside.
Yes. So any other broken promises you want to talk about?
Sure. Yeah, you know, let's take a trip back to Survivor Pearl Islands.
Yes, why not?
Let's go back to episode 3. You know, the Morgans are not having any luck with these challenges. And it really comes down to, for Andrew Savage and his crew, do we cut Dara or do we cut the great Lillian Moss? And there's a conversation that they have pre-tribal council, and it's quite funny. So Andrew approaches Lil and he's like, you know, so how would you feel if you were the one to go tonight? And anytime you ask somebody that question, you're not really going to be met with much enthusiasm. So she responds, you know, very, very resentful. He goes through. It's funny. It, within that specific scene, Andrew's kind of, you know, kind of married to the fact that Lil's torch is already snuffed, and he's kind of just seeing how she's going to react, so to speak. He's kind of divorcing himself from fully engaging with her as an active player in this game. Cut to 10 minutes later in that episode, she's not. He does say to her, you know what, I respect what you've done for this tribe, and, you know, I would pay the respect of telling you that you're going to go home if you're the one that's going. You know, cut to when Burton and Lil rejoin the game after that wonderful Outcast twist, and both Drake and Morgan merge. Andrew approaches Lil, pre-tribal council, the one he goes home in, and he, you know, essentially goes through, you know, you're going to stick with us. And she's like, well, you know, the same people who voted me out are the same ones that are still in this game. I remember watching that and just thinking, you know, did you think he was going to like replace them with new people or something? It's a bit ridiculous.
Hey, it made sense at the time.
I'm sure it did, Lil. I'm sure it did.
Yeah. Well, I have a clip of what Lil said to Andrew Savage at that moment.
Yeah.
Remember I asked you to let me know before?
Remember? Remember you said? Remember you called me Wimpy Lil, the non-leader? Wimpy Lil, non-leader? Remember you called me that? Remember? No, that was an expression.
Wimpy little non-leader.
Yeah, I mean, it's so poetic in a way, because you never, ever see someone who gets voted out and comes back into the game and essentially pays the person who essentially sent them home and in turn sent them packing as a result, which is unfortunate for Andrew, but, you know, that season was quite different than the ones that had come before. But yeah, it's a funny little one. And you can't really totally blame Andrew for what he did. You know, if the game plays out as standard season does, Lil goes out pre-jury, he doesn't have to deal with her, and the Morgans go on and potentially, you know, maybe overthrow Drake at the merge, maybe not. Yeah, it's just when he handles her in that moment of the merge, he's he essentially calls her naive to think that the Drakes won't cut her, and he doesn't really treat her with the respect that he should be, because she really is the kingmaker in that moment. And it's really her vote that, you know, decides him going home.
Now, Stephen, we've identified the broken promise and when it happens on Survivor, but do you have any examples or takeaways about how does the player who broke a promise, like Andrew Savage in this situation, how does he rectify it with the person he broke a promise to?
I think you have to be honest. You have to be honest about your lies. And I think that's something that you did really well in the Amazon when you, you know, went to Matthew at Final Seven and you were like, I've been lying to you, but here's what's really been going on. You have to own it. And I think people respect you when you own your lies. And if you took her side and said, you know what, Lil, that was on me. I'm sorry. I didn't come to you before the vote. You went home. And, you know, from the bottom of my heart, I'm sorry. And really, you know, really, really bend down and hands and knees and kiss her feet. But, you know, Andrew Savage is quite a proud Survivor player. That's not really something that he's ever going to do. But yeah, if he was just really earnest and honest and, you know, she did like him and she did respect him as a leader on that tribe. And he did do it dirty a little bit. And I think if he just came at her really honestly, and I think that's the approach that any Survivor player should take in this respect if they're ever get caught up in a broken promise.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah has talked about that type of idea of, you know, just coming clean with what you did and owning it. But you brought up myself and talking with Matthew about, you know, being honest with him about the lies that I had been putting out there. And that is something that's, you know, very topical to me because Taryn and I just finished doing this Big Brother 2 audiobook. And that was something that really was very much top of mind for me after watching Dr. Will in that season and then going back and hearing him talk about that. He would always say that I am the biggest liar in the house, but everybody trusts me because I tell everybody, hey, I'm lying to everybody, but I'm, you know, being truthful to you about the lies that I'm telling. And he said, like, what are they thinking? But it is a way to sort of make people feel like that you're trustworthy because you are confessing to them about these lies that you're telling.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, it is nothing that people like more. It's an honest liar.
People hate hypocrites. People do. You know, it's almost like the honest liar in some ways is better than the person who lies but says that they're pious. You know, that's where you end up with a coach losing final tribal councils, where you have to be able to cop to the things that you did. And I'm not talking about Tony or Sarah. You have to be able to identify, yes, I did do this bad thing. I know it was bad, but I did it. But here's the reason why I had to do it. I hope you can understand where I'm coming from on this.
Yeah, I think it creates a sense of openness and vulnerability that people can be reciprocal to. Because, you know, if you're defensive about your lies and you shell up, you're going to turn away from that. And yeah, I think being as honest and transparent as possible about all the misdeeds that you've done in the game and broken promises and the lies, that's going to pay dividends to you. It may not seem like it at the time, and you may have to swallow some pride to do it, but it's going to help you in the long run.
Because there's two different things there. Because one is, I lied to you in the past, okay? But now we are talking in truthful terms. But when you lied in the past or had a broken promise in the past, and then in the present, we're having a conversation and I'm still trying to get one over on you or shift things, or like it still feels like to you, I'm trying to pull something over on you. And when I drop that facade, then there's an opportunity to move on and have some sort of an open conversation from that point on. But until that point, it just feels like that you are still making me feel like I'm stupid.
Exactly. And if there's one thing that people don't like to believe about themselves is that they're stupid.
People hate that.
They feel like they do, apparently so. Who knew?
Who knew?
People want to think that they're smart. And, you know, was it Danielle, Double D, DiLorenzo, that they're the hero of their own story? And if you kind of interrupt that journey.
He was the hustler of their own story.
The hustler, hustler. But yeah, if you make someone look stupid or feel like they're stupid, they're less inclined to trust you, unless of course you're Danielle from Big Brother 14.
Different Danielle.
Different Danielle.
Okay, let's talk about the third lie that Survivor players tell.
Perfect. So I you know, was kind of inspired by AJ Nass when he talks about the marriage of convenience. So when it comes to lies specifically, I try to you know, simplify them as possible. And lies, are, you know, just for the record, they're not simple. But in breaking down this third lie, I call it the proactive liar. With a proactive liar, you have a set goal in mind when you're approaching someone to lie to them. You have an outcome that you want to get, and if you can obtain it, then, you know, more power to you. So that really is something that I observed in some capacities with some of these players. And one of the most iconic lies of all time in Survivor, we'd be remiss not to discuss it, is again Survivor Pearl Islands, filled with lies that season. Your good friend Johnny Fairplay and the dead grandmother lie.
Mm-hmm.
So John came into the game in the pregame and decided that he wanted to use his friend Thunder D to come out to the island if he made that far to the family visit and tell him that his grandmother had passed away. And John played this up, you know, throughout the game. And it's really one of these funny, but, you know, most iconic moments of the show's history. And it really does stand the test of time when you look at what John was trying to do. He was trying to leverage himself in a position where he could get advantage, where he could speak with his friend, run scenarios, talk game, and really kind of potentially set him up in a decent position, and it drew sympathy from a lot of the tribe members as well.
You describe this as a premeditated lie.
So it's a premeditated proactive lie. So John had a specific goal that he wanted to get out of it. He wanted to gain an advantage, leverage over his fellow competitors, and he was able to succeed. You know, the Balboa 7-6 minus John. Through the reward challenge, so John could get time to spend with his friend Thunder D and talk about the game and just talk to us about how his grandmother's at home watching Jerry Springer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really dead, but it was at the time I remember watching it, and you know, I thought it was funny, but it was kind of ingenious at the time.
It was a paradigm shift in terms of like what people could potentially do on these shows. I think that the biggest advantage wasn't necessarily that he got to win that challenge, but then he had this thing that he could swear on in his grandmother's grave, or, you know, that he had this thing of gravitas that he was able to incorporate into his character. So it ends up being like a real positive thing for him. And then outside of the game, it's what ultimately ends up making him a reality superstar at that time. And still to this day, everybody remembers the dead grandma lie. So it ends up sort of like living in infamy, probably more so outside of the show than any particular advantage it gave him in the game.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only real person who saw past it was, you know, the eventual winner, Sandra, who was like, you know, immediately when she gets a chance to take a shot at Thunder D, she's like, fair plays, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't care for it at all. And you know, that can either speak to the cutthroat mentality of Sandra and how she plays Survivor, or she was just being mean because she didn't care for Johnny Fairplay. But I found that to be a little kind of a nuance to that part of the lie that really was interesting, that she, out of everyone else, was the only one that saw through it, and everyone else was like, oh, Sandra, how could you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone was protesting. That for me is probably, you know, my favorite lie out of any lie that's ever been told on the show.
Are there any other lies that you could think of in that category of the premeditated lie?
Yeah, actually, staying on point with Sandra Diaz-Twine, let's take a trip to Heroes versus Villains. You know, we get to the final 12. Boston Rob has just been voted out in that iconic showdown between him and Russell, where Coach has thrown his vote away. He didn't really pick a side, but essentially in not picking a side, he picked a side, not Russell's side. And so we cut to Courtney and Sandra. You know, they're low women on the totem pole. And, Sandra's like, do you want to get even with Coach? And she, you know, really thinks about playing into Russell's ego. And, you know, if he's the type of person that finds out if you're going for him, he's going to essentially cut you. So then we cut to where Russell and Sandra are on the beach. And Sandra's, I think she's like making circles in the sand. She's kind of half paying attention, half not. And I think that really kind of pays to how she was able to get this lie off the ground, because it was so casual and she worked it so well. So she says to Russell, you know, at the same time, I heard Coach was saying that he made a mistake and he wished he could go back. And Russell's like, what mistake? And then she says, well, letting Boston Rob go home. And, you know, that's what he told her. She points to Jerry and that he wanted to get rid of you. So I don't know about your homeboy. And when you look at certain words like homeboy or special friend favor, going back to letting Boston Rob, you look at these little colloquialisms that we use when we talk to people, either in our day-to-day life or on Survivor. It's to kind of, you know, engender a familiarity and build up a friendship. And she kind of uses that against Russell, trying to make it sound like that Coach is trying to make Russell look like a fool. And, you know, Russell responds, oh, he ain't my homeboy. I don't trust him. Obviously, you can't trust him because of that right there. He's going behind my back, saying stuff like that. You know, he's digging his own grave, just like Rob did. And then we get that infamous confessional where, yeah, Russell's done good so far, but with me, he doesn't know what he's got himself into.
Yeah.
And for me, that was, you know, it's premeditated. It's a proactive lie on Sandra's part to ensure that her and Courtney survive the next 2 days to get them to the final 11. And it was so clever. And really, it's something that really shouldn't work, because if you really pay attention to it, it's not necessarily a desperate attempt. I don't want to label it as desperate. But in terms of when you view someone on the bottom, how they use their language, it's usually less casual with the way Sandra does it. And that's why she's so good at the game. She doesn't put pressure. She really kind of tells you matter-of-factly what's going on, whereas someone in that position would sell Russell their own mother to stay in the game, and that would push him away. But Sandra's able to effectively identify one of Russell's weaknesses is, and really hit home with it. And she, you know, plays Russell and destroys Coach.
To me, this is almost, I know we're going to talk about the reactive lies eventually, but to me, it's almost like that the opposite of the previous lie of the broken promise, where that's more like, if this is a premeditated murder, that's like manslaughter. That's that, you know, I ended up lying. I didn't intend to. I intended to keep my word. Things just changed. It happened. I don't really understand how we got into the situation, where this is, I have a goal, I want this to happen, and to accomplish that goal, I am going to go out there and perpetrate this falsehood intentionally so I get what I want. That is the premeditated lie here.
It's pretty messed up when you think about it.
Yeah.
Lie, you know, you don't intend to lie, and then you do, and then you're crucified for it, and then you do intend to lie, and you get rewarded for it.
Yeah.
It's the beauty of lies. That's why they're so much more fun than telling the truth.
Do you feel like that the premeditated lie is celebrated much more than the accidental lie, like we're talking about in the previous category of lies?
I think when you look at it from the context of Survivor, I think it is more regarded. People do more regard it more favorably than a broken promise, because there's a lot more bitterness associated with a broken promise. You know, you look at like Trish and Tony in Kagayan. She destroys him at the final tribal council, and she's hurt by him cutting her at the final five. And and same thing with Lex and Kathy at the final tribal council. They go in on Boston Rob for how he played the game. And you know, it's viewed because you've personally built a relationship with somebody and you decidedly cut them at the expense of your own game. Whereas with the proactive lies, they're kind of more isolated in the sense that there you have a specific goal and it's isolated and you deliver on what you're trying to do, whereas you're kind of left festering with the promise for a period of time, and the person you're lying to feels like, oh, they're in for a payday if they just hang in with you. and then, you know, you cut them, it cuts a little bit more deeper, I think.
But I do think that there is a distinction in terms of how the audience receives these, because I feel like that the audience does really enjoy watching the premeditated lie. The audience really gets excited for, hey, here's what I'm going to do next. And you end up seeing, like, I'm going to tell people this, and everybody goes nuts when that happens. Going back to the broken promise, though, you end up having this thing where, oh, people are wishy-washy. And I do think that the audience turns on a lot of these people who said they were going to do something, and then they end up sort of like in a weak moment, or for personal gain or for selfish reasons, they end up going back on that. To go bring it back to the Boston Rob example, I think what I was saying I didn't like about that was it was a broken promise that he tried to frame as the premeditated proactive lie when it was actually the first thing. And I think that that's why it gets thought of as more of a move, as opposed to him just being a little more wishy-washy of he got what he wanted and then changed his mind.
Yeah, no, that completely makes sense. I mean, you know, when you watch Survivor as a viewer, you know, the proactive lie is you're told what it's going to be. It's almost very immediate when you find out what it's going to be, and you're kind of more rooting for that person to pull it off. Whereas, as you mentioned, you do come across as a bit more of a hypocrite and, you know, selfish to the audience, and it's something that you're inclined to root for with the broken promise.
I think that if somebody's going to go play in a future Survivor season and listens to this, try to make your lies the proactive, premeditated ones that you can plan out better than just making a bunch of promises and then bouncing checks.
Absolutely. And I know it's easier said than done, because, you know, you could be faced with, you know, the dilemma with Jonathan Penner in the Philippines, where he doesn't want to commit to a final four with Lisa, and then you're left out in the cold.
I just thought it was a little early for that.
I apologize, Penner. I apologize.
All right.
You don't want to be left out in the cold too. So it's a fine line to walk.
All right, Stephen, the fourth lie.
Fourth lie. Yeah, we're going to step away from the proactive liars, and we're going to move on to more of the mechanics of the game, because, you know, we tell lies with our mouth, but more often than not, we can do that with our actions as well. So we're going to be looking at challenges and how they relate to people lying within the game. So I've broken this up into two parts. So with regards to the first part, cheating, as I put it in inverted commas, in relation to challenges. And yeah, I know what you might be thinking is like, you know, how can you cheat in a challenge? No, nobody's ever gotten disqualified from a challenge. Actually, no, that's not true. Rob, Skater Rob,
yes.
You know, the attack zone.
Yes, when he lost because of a bunch of rules.
A bunch of rules. You know, God forbid that they'd have rules and challenges. But yeah, you know, when it comes to cheating, you know, one of the most interesting ones that I, you know, observed, you know, it's in Survivor Blood versus Water, where Redemption Island is in play. And, you know, nobody up until that point, there only been two iterations of Redemption Island, and they were pretty straightforward. Everyone played in the challenges, and Matt Albert won, sent somebody home, etc. But you know, you've got two post-merge where Laurel Moret, Avidus, and Tina are on Redemption Island, and they're doing that challenge, you know, where you have to swivel the colored blocks and make sure there's no repeating color
right.
In each column. And, you know, Laurel Moret has proven to be a beast. She was already returned from Redemption Island to make it to the merge. And at this point, she's been voted out again. She finishes her puzzle relatively quickly. And it really comes down to Tina and Vidas. And I remember seeing in her Ponderosa video later on, as she, you know, illuminates further on what she did. You know, she was sitting back and was thinking, oh, who will win, Vidas or Tina? And then a second question pops into her head, who do I want to win? And, you know, she assists Tina. She tells her what colors need to go where. And she swivels her. She keeps batting her finished puzzle so that Vidas can't look. And eventually, you know, Tina finishes the challenge, and Vidas is very close right behind her. But it's such an effective way to eliminate your opponent directly or indirectly, so to speak, with her in the game. And I just thought it was fascinating that a lot of other people haven't tried to do that since.
Yeah, I mean, we saw David Wright end up in the final six, I think, of Millennials versus Gen X, where that Jay didn't end up covering his, I forget if it was like a puzzle or a combination. And so we do see that from time to time. And Jeff's going to allow it.
Yeah, I was just specifically referring to Redemption Island itself. But yeah, no, we have seen it with, you know, with David and the rest of the final six. You know, Jay finishes his puzzle, he gets to cover it, and everyone's looking in. You know, there's a number of examples. You know, the women in One World looking at the men's puzzle, they still end up losing. You know, but people are going to do it. If there's an opportunity to do it, like, you know, Bobby John, Stephanie in Palau, looking over at Kobe and Greg, and they still end up losing the puzzle because they suck. But yeah, I mean, if there's an opportunity to do it, why not? It's within the confines of the rules. Jeff Phelps is going to allow it, as you say. And it fights for some interesting television.
Now, Stephen, why do you classify that as a lie?
I wanted to, you know, incorporate the mechanics of the game into this process, because you see people achieving challenges. And you know, it's not necessarily a quote-unquote lie, but it is a deception. You're trying to throw somebody off. You're trying to essentially beat them at a puzzle that they're potentially going to win. So you're kind of, you know, trying to trip them up, throw marbles at them, but before they can finish the race, so to speak. But yeah, I wanted to include it just because it's a fascinating aspect of the game itself when it comes to challenges, and I thought it did deserve a spot on this list. Just so you could talk, we could approach that subject on whether or not it is an accurate form of an attack when you're against somebody in a challenge.
Okay, what other sorts of deception can people pull off in a challenge?
You know, so it's you can either, as Michaela did in Millennials versus Gen X, she wanted to ensure that the new Tukali tribe went to tribal council. So she assisted Michelle and Zeke in finishing off that puzzle. You know, you can help other tribes if it's like a three tribe format and you want the lesser of the two tribes to finish the puzzle before the other one. Other tribe does, so they go to tribal council and lose a member. So it's kind of using those tactics in challenges that can, you know, essentially help you long term in your tribe. Going to the second part of that is you know, one that we cover time and time again, and we see it quite often, and we did see it this season on Game Changers, or it was alluded to more so in exit interviews, but throwing challenges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since poor old Silas back in Africa, all the way going to, you know, the great Billy Garcia in Cook Islands. There have been many people have been the victim of challenges being thrown. And it really, you look at the tribes that throw the challenges, and their reasoning behind them is to get rid of them because they're lazy or they could be a threat down the line. And deceiving them in that way, kind of sandbagging them in the challenge when that's their, you know, opportunity to save themselves for another round, it's quite deceptive, and, you know, I wanted to illuminate that in this section.
Yeah, and this is a deception that you're ending up pulling off on one person in your tribe, where you are making it seem like you are trying your hardest, but in reality, you're really trying to get rid of that person, but they, for the most part, shouldn't know about this.
Exactly, and I mean, you know, sometimes the person ends up going home as a result of this plan. You know, the great Drew Christie is a great example, who wanted to throw the challenge and did throw the challenge in San Miguel del Sur, but he ends up going home as a result instead of his intended target, Kelly. So sometimes it can backfire, and can backfire bad. But I think it's all about timing when it comes to this one, because you don't want to throw a challenge too early, but you don't want to throw it too late either. There's a fine point in the middle of doing this. You know, you look at Redemption Island with, you know, the Zaps getting rid of Russell. That really hurt them later on in the game. It was their first tribal council, and they wanted to get rid of him because they thought he was toxic to their camp. But then again, you look at the likes of PG and Jamie in China, who post-swap on Zhang Hu, throw the challenge, they're throwing puzzle pieces away to get rid of Aaron. And they were going to do the same thing with James the following one if Denise wasn't so terrible at swallowing the loot.
Is the 11th lie lies that Survivor players tell at the reunion show? Or does that count the first thing about lying about your profession?
No, I think it does, you know, count into the profession. But it was probably a poorly constructed lie on her part.
All right, before we get to the fifth lie that Survivor players tell, let me thank our sponsor for this episode of the podcast, Stephen, and those are our friends over at canvaspeople.com. And now with summer here, you know what that means: vacations, weddings, barbecues, parties. Of course, plenty of pictures are going to be taken. And what's the best thing to do with these pictures? Not just put them on Instagram for a second. You want to be framing them and putting them up in your house. And that's what canvaspeople.com is going to help you do, because they've got a great offer where you can get an 11 by 14 photo and you will have it turned into a beautiful work of art from Canvas People for $0. Just use the promo code RHAP in the promo code box to get that special $0 pricing. All you have to do is pay the shipping. It's going to be less than $20 total, and you've got this great piece of art that you're going to be able to put on your wall, and that is no lie. Canvas People is very easy to use. You just go ahead and upload your photo. They do the rest. You can use any of their templates if you want and turn it into something that is going to capture those summer memories. So go ahead and take advantage of this special offer, which is no lie, not like one of these eight types of falsehoods that you see on Survivor. The 11 by 14 photo canvas, normally $69.99, is yours for $0 pricing with the promo code RHAP at canvaspeople.com. Just pay the shipping. That's canvaspeople.com, promo code RHAP. Okay, let's get into the fifth type of lie that players tell on Survivor.
Perfect. Number five. We know a lot of survivors that, you know, they like to steal, right?
They do.
They do, unfortunately. So that is topic number five in relation to these lies. You see it.
And we're not just talking about when they make an internet cycler.
No, we're not just talking about that.
That's different.
Or a pyramid scheme.
Those two.
When I was going through the extensive list, because there's a lot of things that these survivors like to steal, whether it's food, clothes, you know, a machete here, a machete there. I really wanted to drill down on, you know, the reasons why they do it. And really, I kind of boiled it down to four reasons, you know, for mainly from a psychological standpoint, you know, whether you want to inflict, you know, paranoia on people, like with and distress with what Russell was able to do in Samoa with burning Jason's socks and dumping out the water and hiding the machete in Heroes versus Villains. To revenge is probably like one of the main reasons why people steal. You know, whether it's Sandra dumping out the fish, or in part, as we talked about earlier with the Sugargate scandal, that was, you know, primarily to set up JT and send him out the door. To, you know, selfish reasons, like Taylor and Millennials versus Gen X with his mason jars and, you know, eating the food at night, to, you know, tribal or alliance advantages. And then you have the mystery reasons why people steal, like, you know, who stole Abby Maria's bracelet? We still don't know. Will we ever know?
I think Abby Maria just lost it.
I think she just lost it and just like was like, okay, someone stole this. And even in your season with the great Janet Koff being the fall guy for the granola bar incident, we still don't know if it was her or if, you know, production left behind a granola bar.
Yeah, to be fair, that was more of a smuggle than a steal, but I think it does fall into the same category.
Yeah, I'll get a pass on that one. But yeah. Going back to the tribal alliance advantage, Jervis and Tyson did this effectively in Blood versus Water with the Coconut Bandits. Get to one of, you know, Jervis's quotes with regards to this. He says in a secret scene that, you know, we both have a secret that we want to keep. We're doing something that we know people wouldn't appreciate. And we're trusting each other with that secret, and it's perfect. It's the start of a beautiful relationship together, and it's carried us all the way through. And, you know, one of the funny things that I noticed about them when they were talking about it in the episode is that, you know, Laura B, the great Laura Bonham, you know, was getting suspicious about, you know, oh, where's, where are all the coconuts going? And, you know, what's going on? And Monica Culpepper really kind of saves them and says, oh, maybe, you know, maybe it was a crab that ate all the coconuts. And really sometimes someone can add to your lie and make it that more believable without them even knowing it. And that's beautiful in itself for them. They didn't get caught.
Yeah, you got to watch out for those crabs that come up and eat all the coconuts. That's always a big concern for the survivors.
Going to, you know, back to Pearl Islands, you know, I'm really contrasting what she was able to do in Pearl Islands versus Game Changers, dumping out the fish after Rupert gets sent home. She, you know, causes a commotion, starts cussing out Johnny Fairplay left and right, and she's dropping F-bombs here and F-bombs there, saying he can't be trusted, and he'll stab you in the back. And, you know, she later says in confessional, she tripped over on a vine, and, you know, all the fish came pouring out, and, you know, it got to the point where, you know, they were blaming poor old Krista, who was, you know, an innocent bystander, but sometimes the innocent bystander gets run over, and Krista did get the blame for that. Versus in Game Changers, when she decides to take all the sugar, because she knows that Michaela and JT are the only two people that have the sugar with her coffee, and she kind of plans to see, and JT's like, well, I guess we know who ate all the sugar, and she's like, yeah, I guess we did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it cuts to, you know, that great iconic face shot she gives to the camera,
right,
where she's like, oh, you know. And then the tribal council, she announces after JT goes on that it was her that stole the sugar, and it's a laughable affair. But they do contrast each other, those two deceptions, so to speak, that Sandra does. She, you know, she's in the shadows for the first lie, but she's more so out in front and reveals that lie to her other tribe mates, which kind of are two direct differences in her styles of play for both of those seasons. She's, you know, low-key under the radar, and it's anyone but me, and whereas in Game Changers, she's, you know, out in front and more aggressive. But, mm-hmm. You know, I love that she was able to draw from that, you know, her bag of tricks to share with everyone, you know, that she was able to still pull off a great steal and a lie like that.
And the difference between the two, you know, one was just this reactive thing that she's so mad at those guys, she's going to throw away the fish after they voted out Rupert. But then the second thing was like this premeditated version of a lie that we talked about earlier, where she's like has this goal that she wants to do, and she announces it before she does it. It's not like, you know, oh, I really want all this sugar, so let me just go ahead and now I've eaten the sugar, now I need to come up with a lie to figure, you know, because people are going to wonder where the sugar is.
Yeah, it is really only with Jeff she shares that until after the tribal council. But yeah, it's just fascinating to see how she's able to do it with such ease, whereas any, you know, any standard survivor player who isn't at, you know, Sandra's caliber would, you know, probably stump and fall over and you know, get exposed and end up going home for it. But yeah, it's just great to see. And when you compare it to a lie, you know, going all the way back to Survivor Australia, where, you know, poor old Kel is accused of smuggling in beef jerky, and he, you know, he comes back sheepishly to the Ogrecore camp, and it's like, well, you know, you girls can use my razor if you want, and really that kind of exposes him as being guilty in essence, because, mm-hmm. You know, why would you offer something to somebody if
a concession
if you're accused? Exactly, yeah, it's something that if you're going to follow through in it, you have to be confident, and you can't, you know, back down and show any kind of remorse or feel bad, because people are going to see you as wishy-washy and distrust you.
Do you recommend the gambit of stealing food if you're one of the survivors?
I do, but the thing is, A, you have to either think whether you're going to tell somebody, and if you're going to tell somebody, can you trust that person 100%? Are they, you know, within your core alliance? And two, don't be so out in the open about it. Don't move away from camp if you're going to do it. Do it on the sly. You know, I think Sandra had a stash of, you know, bananas that her and Courtney would have in Heroes versus Villains that the rest of the villains tried to know about. And, you know, you just have to be really careful about it. And really, like, in my opinion, don't tell anybody. Do not tell a soul. Steal what you want and make sure it's out of dodge, and nobody can, you know, point a finger in your direction. So yeah, I think there is room to do it, but don't be so obvious like someone like Taylor and get up in the middle of the night when everyone's sleep, trying to sleep and just you know, pick apart mason jars and, you know, that's, you know, you just don't do that.
All right. Anything else from the fifth lie? Ready to talk about the sixth lie?
Yes. Yeah, no, we can move on to the sixth lie, which, you know, is, you know, the compatriot to the proactive lie. It's the reactive lie. Now, one of the things that I wanted to discuss with you, specifically in your season, because I think you handle this as best as you could do in the Amazon, and we're coming to the final seven. It's final six, post Alex Bell blindside, where you are having a conversation with Jenna, and you're saying, you know, I told my mom yesterday, I said, Mom, I think I'll get to the final two. We've done a lot of bad things, and I don't think I can win. So at this time, if I decide to do this, I've thought this all the way through of how it's going to be me and you in the final two. Mm-hmm. And you speak to Jenna about that.
I remember.
And yeah, so you speak to Jenna about that, and she's kind of like humming and hawing, and you essentially say to her that, you know, well, you know, you don't want to reveal too much information to her about how the rest of the votes are going to go, because she could turn around and expose you. And, you know, she's in confessional, and she's calling you a snake, and it's not really a nice thing to be called. Especially since you're surrounded by them
mm-hmm.
in the Amazon. And yeah, she's not really your number one fan, so to speak, in that moment. So then she immediately goes back to hiding and basically tells her everything. And she wants to take you out. And she, you know, cuts her own confession saying that you're the puppet master and you're stringing these people along. And she refuses to go along with your quote unquote crappy plan.
It was a good plan. I take offense to it as a crappy plan.
Yeah, I would take offense, because it was good, and it was, you know, you really formulated out how it was going to go, and you know, you could see that as a viewer how your end game is trying to figure out, and you know, I think Jenna wasn't really playing from the same standpoint you were, and she was, you know, on the receiving end of a blindside at the last tribal council. So you know, it cuts to you speaking to Heidi, and Heidi's upset, and you know, she's like, "Well, you know, I played a, you know, an honorable game, and I don't want to be, you know, around the, you know, the other five dishonorable people." She goes back to camp, and you say to her before she leaves, "Is she mad?" And she ends up, you know, tearing up and walking away, and then you start following her back to camp, and then she bumps into Jenna, and Jenna's like, "She's had enough," and she goes off. She's going off with you. She's like, you know, exposing you and your conversation. And there's this great moment where you kind of do this, like you've been stabbed in the gut action. And she's like, you know, does Matthew know about your plan? And he's like, yeah, we're in the final four. And, you know, does Christy, does Butch, does, mm-hmm. you know, she goes through the rounds, and she basically says that, you know, the way you're playing, you don't care about personal relationships, which, you know, that's a questionable statement, because I think you have built up these relationships.
Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome. It's just that her perception of your game is different.
Right. I believe she even says, like, you know, if you keep doing what you're doing, then, you know, eventually you're going to win the game. I was like, oh, yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds like a good, I didn't think of it that way.
Sounds like a plan to me. Yeah. I mean, she really doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. And, you know, her and Heidi are in the shelter, and they're like, you know, they don't want to sell out their morals and integrity. And it's like, you know, you say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm playing the same game that you're playing, you know, and it really kind of sums up how the viewer feels, at least me at that moment in time, was like, you know, to hell with these people.
Right.
You know, chastising you for how you want to play the game.
Right, I was such a bad guy until I said, hey, you want to vote out Christy? And then all of a sudden, I was like a good guy again.
Yeah, you were their best friend. And really, that kind of, you know, went against, you know, for both of them. That really wasn't in their best interest to take out Christy. She was a pivotal swing voter in Capwood seat, as Christy likes to say.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I thought how you handled that situation, you didn't... do what a lot of people do. You didn't backtrack or right. You stood your ground. You were strong in that moment, and I think showing that front and one of the things that was really great that what you said was like, did you ever think I was lying to you? And it really, you know, it really kind of it not only exposed her, but the game itself as a whole, that, you know, lying takes place, and you know, you have Matthew Butch and Christy and hiding within the earshot of that, and really it kind of fortifies you as somebody who is you know, not willing, not only willing to lie, but also willing to advance yourself in the game and expose how it's important to do that.
Yeah, Steve, I appreciate that. I think that the concept was good, but, you know, I'm not the most convincing liar if you ever go back and watch that. Like, because then there's, like, another scene, like, right after that where Butch and Matthew are asking me, like, Matthew's like, so what was that all about? I have, like, a handful of food. I'm like, oh, it's literally nothing. It's just crazy talk. I don't even know what she's talking about. I don't know. Those guys did not really press further, and like my voice is like going up like three octaves, like, oh, I don't know. Well, who knows whether like they're just mad.
Yeah, I think if you had been playing with any, no offense to Butch or Matthew, but if you were playing with any other players like from nowadays, they would be a little bit more perceptive and maybe questioning you a little bit more in that moment. But you know, I wanted to illuminate because I felt that was one of the strongest moments in terms of like how you react when you're put on the spot, especially being trying to be exposed by someone like Jenna. You handled yourself very well, I thought so, in that moment.
Okay, well, I do what I can. I do what I can, Stephen. And really, Survivor has just prepared me for being married when I'm just constantly have a person running into the room who's angry at me yelling. So it's served me well.
You have to default.
Yes.
To go back to Amazon mode. Yeah, in contrast, you know, you look at someone like Albert in the Final Tribal Council of South Pacific, who, when he's probed by Brandon Hentz about whether or not he knew that Brandon would be going home the night he gave up immunity, Albert kind of, you know, it's a yes or no answer to the question, and he really tries to dance around, which, you know, pretty much just seems to have been his MO throughout the entire game, is try and tell people what they want to hear, but in a roundabout way that, you know, really doesn't do that. And so it gets to a point where, you know, Brandon is frustrated and he's like, it's a one-word answer, yes or no, or I'll move on. And he eventually says, you know, no, he didn't, which, you know, it's a flat out lie. What were the other options at that moment? Albert had immunity, coach had an idol, and really, Sophie was so insulated in the lines, she wasn't really ever a target. And who is Rick?
Yeah.
You know, it's, he should have been honest and owned it. And especially the Final Tribal Council, where you're essentially in against the firing squad. You really kind of had to own your lies, going back to that earlier conversation, and Albert couldn't do that.
What's the best thing to do in that spot if you're Albert and you're getting put on the spot? I mean, for me, it was a little bit of a different situation where it's almost like the inverse of that Albert situation where I had the two angry accusers trying to make me look bad in front of my allies. And numerically, it made perfect sense for me to say, no, what I was telling you were lies, that I tell these guys the truth. Whereas Brandon has a jury vote that he wants to give, and he wants to know, like, tell me the truth, were you lying to me or not? And you don't even know what he knows. Is he better off with just flat out copping to it? I guess that's probably the answer based on everything else we've talked about, right?
I think there's a way to cop to it without, you know, further alienating Brandon. Like, you know, Albert was the target that day because of his, you know, his deals running around camp and stuff. So, you know, the way to do it is, you know what, Brandon, I did lie, but I did it out of selfishness, out of self-preservation, and I apologize. You know, I'm really kind of playing into the whole Christianity thing, which was a huge theme that season, and really was something that was important to Brandon, and you really went out on a limb for me, and I didn't do the same for you when it was time to tell you that you were going home, and I do apologize.
Right.
You were the target. You know, try and word it that way, at least.
Yeah, because I think it's an insult to injury type idea where then he knows you've already lied to him. And then when you keep insisting like, no, that wasn't a lie. And now you're making the person feel stupid on top of that.
Exactly. And again, as we talked about, you don't want to feel like you're stupid on Survivor.
Yeah. People don't mind being lied to as much as they mind when you make them feel like they're stupid.
Exactly, especially if they're on to your lies and you're still lying, and it's like, for God's sake, just own it already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else from reactive lies?
Going back to Blood versus Water, it's a really short scene between the great Monica Culpepper and the great Kat Ederson. Kat is running her mouth a bit too much to Tina, who she thinks she can trust, talking about how Monica is always strategizing and, you know, maybe we should get rid of her. Cut to Tina spilling all of this back to Monica, saying that Kat's gunning for her. Monica confronts Kat, and Kat doesn't really handle it very well. Really saying that no, she flat out denies that she wasn't saying anything to Tina about going for Monica. But Monica has built a lot of trust with Tina with that alliance that they have with Tyson and Oris and Jervis. So she's going to trust her word a lot more than Kat, someone who's been on the outs and hasn't really proven to be that keen or strategically minded, so to speak. So her lies do get exposed, and even more so get compounded when they eventually go to tribal council. And, you know, Vidas really shows his chops when he
Your
talks
favorite.
About how... Yeah, my favorite. You know, I do like Vidas, and I was, you know, I feel a little bad for making a joke earlier on. You know, I felt bad how we went out and...
Don't lie, you don't feel bad.
I do. I actually voted for him to get on the cast. I did, because I felt that he deserved a second chance. But he further compounds, we're going to go back as one tribe, and, you know, I can be trusted and Kat can't be. And, you know, she's promptly dispatched to Redemption Island, and that, great famous line of, you know, you don't want to date somebody who doesn't make the merge comes about. But yeah, it's one of those, Survivor 101s. Don't, you know, if you lie and you're caught in the lie, own it. And, you know, unfortunately she wasn't able to own it, and she further dug her own grave.
Yeah, Vidas is really great in those two tribal councils with Kat and Laura Bonham back to back. So great stuff from his highlight reel in Blood versus Water. All right. So the seventh lie that Survivor players tell, Stephen, what is it?
Yes. So, you know, we're going back to the mechanics of the game, and, you know, the hidden immunity idol has been forever ingrained with us since Survivor Guatemala. And I really wanted to explore this, really kind of looking at idol misplays, fake idols, possession or lack of possession of idols within the game. And also, you know, we touched upon this earlier with Brandon, but giving up immunity and how that comes about. Because it's not just, again, with... broken promises or lying about your profession. The hidden immunity idol has been a tool in one of the greatest lies, as well as the immunity necklace in itself. And that's something I wanted to explore with this.
So what's the biggest lie here when people say they have a real idol and it's a fake one?
Yeah, you look to, a great example of this is Rupert in Heroes versus Villains. He's on the block. It's really between him, Colby, and Candace, unbeknownst to Candace. And Jeff, at that immunity challenge, tells the tribe that, there's an idol back in play after Russell misplayed it, the previous tribal council. So everyone goes on a mad dash, and Rupert knows he's on the line. And he's like, oh, I can't find this. Picks up a rock, puts it in his pocket, and he kind of walks back into camp, and, you know, he shuffles his shorts pocket and kind of, jockeys a little bit to everyone else to, let them know, don't come for me, so to speak. And, it's really a toss-up between whether or not they should, call Rupert on his bluff or send out Candace. And they end up sending out Candace, partly due to the fact that Rupert potentially had an idol on that, she was the one who flipped on Heroes. But I thought that was, I'm not one to give Rupert a lot of strategic credit, because he really isn't really remembered for that in his four times that he's been on the show. But I thought that was a semi-decent
Rupert's best move in four seasons, putting a rock in his pocket.
I think so. Or arguably, people could say his best move was sending himself to Redemption Island and letting Laura play. hockey game going on.
We'll go with The Rock. We'll go with The Rock.
We'll go with The Rock.
So good for Rupert in terms of that. I guess there's the opposite of that when you do have the hidden media idol, and I guess you have to deceive everybody that you don't have it as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing to do, especially in those Exile Island seasons where, you know, you're sent to the one place where the idol is. So it's not like you're in camp and the idol is in the camp where anyone could be a suspect. You do have to kind of play it down. And you see the likes of, you know, Ozzy and Jason. Ozzy is pretty much pinpointed by Eliza on her way out the door in Micronesia that he has the idol after he, you know, plants a fake idol and it's, you know, played by Eliza. And he essentially says he does have the idol because, you know, people are going to assume that he has the idol regardless. And unfortunately for him, you know, that's when Parvati and gang decide to make a move against him and he gets a little bit too comfortable and doesn't play the idol because he thinks Jason's going home that night and he goes home. So what's interesting about that is you get a little bit too relaxed and you're a little bit too comfortable that you have a free pass in your pocket. But there is that little side note where it's like, if you don't play this, you go home. But I think people do get a little bit too comfortable when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So after, you know, Ozzy goes out, Jason, you know, sees his favorite idol go out of the game and he finds a real idol this time, and essentially the same mistake happens to him because he's told by Natalie that he's good, that it's going to be James, but he falls for the same trick. Now, in contrast to that and the hidden immunity idol in itself, one of the more memorable lies comes in the shape of the immunity necklace that poor old Eric Reichenbach gives up at the final five. He's running around camp telling all the girls, Natalie, Parvati, Sri, and Amanda, different shades of the same story that do wants to go with them to the end, etc. And they all swap stories and come together and decide, you know what, we've had enough of this guy. Let's pull one over on him. But unfortunately for them, he wins immunity and, you know, they decide, let's try and tell him that, you know, he has no shot of winning if he doesn't try to redeem himself in front of the jury. And, you know, Cerise starts the conversation and Natalie really puts it into motion when she's like, hear me out. You give me your necklace, and he shoots it down immediately. But then she proceeds to convince him that it makes more sense than at first it appears to be. And then you cut to Tribal Council, where, you know, Amanda and Parvati are really double downing, making him feel bad. And, you know, Suri and Natalie are kind of like, well, you know, really kind of playing good cop to Amanda and Parvati's bad cop. And it really kind of sets in motion Eric's decision to decide to give his immunity necklace up to Natalie. And unfortunately for him, he's promptly voted out and he learns a pivotal lesson that you shouldn't trust women.
You shouldn't trust women? No, that can't be the lesson.
Don't give up your immunity necklace is probably the biggest lesson to come from.
Maybe don't trust these women. Yeah, that's probably...
Don't trust those women.
Let's go with that. Let's go with that.
Yeah, let's go around. Leave that up.
A lesson learned the hard way for Eric Reichenbach.
You know, people, you classify it as a dumb move. But, you know, when you're out there on day 34, day 35, and, you know, someone's selling you, you know, a really, it sounds like a decent story at the time. I mean, as a viewer, you're sitting at home saying, oh, he's an idiot. He's just giving his immunity away. But, you know, you're not in the game. You haven't built these long-term relationships with these people. And there is a certain understanding that you can take into account for how he comes to that decision, albeit not a good one, but it's, you know, it's probably one of the most memorable moments when it comes to blindsides.
Yeah. In fairness to Eric, I mean, it wasn't like he was in a great position to begin with. Like, yeah, he could have potentially Mike Holloway'd his way to the end, but, you know, well, at least he's trying to make a big move.
Exactly. And you know, if nothing else, Jeff Probst likes it when someone makes a move.
He was the first maker of big moves, Eric Reichenbach.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
it was really something that really kind of set the, you know, the Black Widow Brigade apart and really kind of cemented that season as one of the best.
Yeah.
As a result of that.
Now, what about the fake idols and not just like when Rupert puts a rock in his cargo shorts?
Yeah, I mean, you look at Bob from Gabon, or he makes that fake idol and is convinced to give it to Randy, and unfortunately for Randy, you know, everyone starts howling with laughter, with the exception of Corinne and Bob, who watch him play the idol, gets burned by Jeff. He gets unpacking, but, you know, it is one that really gets used to good effect in Worlds Apart by Mike when Joe, you know, Joe sees the writing on the wall that he hasn't won immunity, and he's essentially going to be the next one to go from his no-collar alliance. And he makes a fake idol, and it's a fairly decent one from what I remember. It's he makes it from like the tarot torch and some of the little jewelry on the torches as well. And he goes to Mike and he says, you know, I'll give this to you if, you know, you don't vote for me or send me home. And Mike's like, give it to me now, essentially, because Mike is in the essential power position and Joe is operating from a point of weakness. And what Mike does, he takes it from the tribal council and he, you know, he asks, is this real? He really kind of drills down, you know, is this real? And eventually he decides, you know what, I'm going to test this and play it on Will Sims, which he does. And it's kind of, it's a funny moment when Joe says, this is not hidden immunity idol. And Will's face is like, oh. But, you know, Joe's going home anyway. They just pile the votes on him. And he ends up going home. But I thought it was a slick move on Mike's part to take the power away from what little power that Joe had, take it away from his grasp and kind of use it to his advantage.
Joe is going to regain all of his power once people start checking out his new show with Kelly Wigglesworth. But more on that to come later. Let's talk about the final lie that survivors tell. What is it?
Yes.
That they're going to be famous after the show, the lie they tell themselves?
That is the lie they tell themselves. And you know what? Actually, this isn't the eighth lie, but it almost was just the lie that survivors tell themselves. And I kind of scrapped it because it was really kind of, you know, I was getting a bit too cute with the idea because, you know, I talked about, you know, people's egos on the show and, you know, people get comfortable and play the game out of fear. And yeah, I was just going on this, you know, ridiculous tangent that, you know, not to say that I haven't been making sense all along because God bless the poor people that listen to this podcast and think that I'm making any sense. But yeah, moving on to the eighth lie, I like to call it, and it's an homage to the great Sash Lenahan from Surviving Nicaragua, the Freudian slip.
Okay.
And you know, in the tribal council where it happens, you know, Marty has just you know, tried to build a bit of trust with Sash by giving him the hidden immunity idol because Marty's in a bad position on that new LaFleur tribe. And what Sash does at the tribal council, unfortunately for him, he makes quite a slip up when he talks about how if he ever loses trust in his tribe, when in actual fact he probably was trying to say that if they ever lose trust in me, but as Jeff points out, that you know, 90% of what we think is on the just floating above the surface, waiting to come out, which he tries to engage with Fabio. Talking about how if he's familiar with Sigmund Freud's works, which is quite funny. I really wanted to just pay homage to that little slip. And it really doesn't make any difference to Sash. Sash, you know, recovers well and he's in a decent spot. And really nobody ever loses any specific trust with him, even though they blast him at the final tribal council for being deceptive, etc.
Okay, so what Freudian slips are lies?
What I was looking back on the tapes, one of the great ones that I wanted to discuss was, you know, heroes versus villains, you know, and I don't think this gets paid too much attention because it happens in a double episode. It's when, you know, the great Daniel DiLorenzo gets sent home, and considering the arc that villains alliance had with Parvati, Daniel, and Russell, and how it ends, it ends up on kind of like an afterthought after the first tribal council with Candace. I felt like it could have been in a full episode in and itself because there was a lot to unpack. You have Russell makes a note the next day after the previous tribal council that, you know, he wants to regain some control in the game. He wants to split up Parvati and Danielle because he feels like he's been kind of moved out of the house, so to speak, and Danielle's moved in his spot. So he decides to pit Danielle and Parvati against each other. Mm-hmm. He goes to Danielle talking about how they should get rid of Parvati. And he goes to Parvati's and he says, you know, Danielle was talking about getting rid of you. And what he doesn't take into account is that he's playing with returning players who aren't just going to take that at face value on day 32 or day 33 and be like, oh, you know what? He's right. You know, Danielle is coming for me. Parvati's like, well, I want to go talk to Danielle. Now Danielle is like, wait, what? Why would you want to do that? You don't want to do that. And I was like, I'm not just going to not talk to her. Like, she's been with us from day one, and she's in my, you know, final three alliance. So she goes back to Danielle, and they basically marry up their two stories and essentially find out that Russell's lying. But Russell's still on the warpath. He recruits Kobe and Rupert are on the outs, and they're more than happy to write down Danielle's name. And this leads to Jerry Mankey being the swing vote, and Paragon Danielle go to her. It's like, he's crazy. Just whatever you do, don't write down Danielle's name. And, you know, Russell, you know, goes on a threatening warpath as he threatens both Parvati and Jerry. Like, you know, I'm not going to be able to stop them. They're going to vote you out next if you don't do what I say. And, you know, Jerry's like, oh, don't threaten me. I don't know what's going on. And he's like, well, things are happening and I can't tell you. And you just need to follow my lead and vote out, write down Danielle's name tonight. And it's a kind of a back and forth between both Parvati and Danielle. And Russell for Jerry's vote on that day. But, you know, one of the things that I think it's important to note, and I don't know if you've ever come across this before, it's an acronym called DARVO.
Yeah, what is it? DARVO?
DARVO, D-A-R-V-O. Not to be confused with DARVO, the Dharma Initiative.
And DARVO Conger, right.
Yeah, exactly. So really the breakdown of that is, you know, deny, attack, and reverse victim and offender. And really, you see that primarily in abusive relationships.
Can you give us that one more time? What is the acronym?
So DARVO is a deny, attack, and reverse victim and offender. So essentially what you're doing with this is you, let's say, for instance, you come home and you were supposed to cook dinner for your girlfriend, your boyfriend, whoever, and you didn't. And they call you out on it, and then you turn it around on them. And it's like, well, I thought you were going to cook dinner, and why haven't you cooked dinner? And then that may throw caution to the wind, and they're, you know, self-doubting. And then that's when you double down and you turn them into the victim. When in actual fact, you probably were the one that was supposed to cook dinner. You're trying to manipulate and control the situation. And, you know, you see it sometimes in Survivor, going back to, not to go back too far back to Lex and Boston Rob, but, you know, he really gets in Lex's face and kind of puts it back on Lex that, you know, if I could have saved you, I could. And he kind of puts it back on Lex that, you know, it's his own fault. And, you know, with what Russell's able to do, he makes Danielle look more shady than an actual reality. She was, you know, being loyal to that alliance and to Parvati and to Russell. And, you know, you cut to that tribal council where he is really, you know, he cuts her twice during that tribal council. He's like, can you let me finish? And, you know, she's already frazzled at the tribal council. She's in tears. And, you really feel bad for the girl. And, you know, she drops her guard to the point where, as we get to the Freudian slip, you know, I'm closer to Parvati than you think. And it's utilizing those words against people. And he's able to look over Jerry, and he mouths Danielle to her. And that's all it needs for Jerry, who feels like she's already on the outs of that group, and writes down Danielle's name when she goes home because of those, those seven words.
Now, is the lie on the person who ends up making the slip, or is the lie on the person who takes advantage of and tries to twist what the Freudian slip sayer said?
Yeah, it's more so on the person who's trying to get a desired outcome, like sending them home. You look at, let's go to Survivor Vanuatu, one of my favorite Survivor players, Amy Cusack, does this to great effect at the final 12 to the great Lisa Kiefer.
Who?
You know, they're, exactly. some person I can't remember. But yeah, you know, they're camp post-immunity. They lost another challenge, and it looks like poor Rory is out the door. And, you know, for a while it appears with this interaction that Amy has lost a lot of trust with Elisa, with what has happened on the original Yasser camp. And I feel like with how this carries out, it's, you know, she was just looking for a reason to get rid of Lisa. But, you know, Lisa is like taken to the fire, and she says, she makes an innocuous statement like, oh, can you show me where the manioc is just in case? And she really doesn't finish that sentence. And Amy laughs, and she's like, ha, just in case what, Lisa? And Lisa kind of laughs and brushes it off. And then, you know, it cuts to a scene where Amy, Lisa, and Scout are, I think they're chopping down branches or leaves or whatever in the forest. And, you know, they're talking about the vote tonight and talking about how, you know, it's going to be Rory. And Amy turns and says, you know what, I don't want to vote for Rory. My vote's going to be for Lisa. Like, straight up, it's going to be for Lisa. And, you know, Scott's quite funny in that scene. She's like, Lisa, this Lisa? And Lisa really is like, what happened? You know, and she, Amy capitalizes on the words that Amy, as not Amy, Lisa used. And it's primarily called a lie of fabrication. So she adds a lie to a truth. She says, you know, Lisa, you said that you wanted me to show you where the manioc is just in case I'm not around. Now, in the episode, we don't see Lisa specifically say just in case you're not around, but because Amy is able to capitalize on something that Lisa did say and add a lie to it, she's able to manifest distrust in Lisa's direction. And Lisa really doesn't handle herself at all well in that. She really kind of like goes on the defensive and it's like, oh, baby, no, I would never vote for you. You'd be the last one, which, you know, it's kind of really bad, you know, like you wouldn't vote for her unless she was the last person left. You'd still vote her out. But you know, at that point, you just really need to be like, oh, I didn't mean to say that at all. That's not what was intended for. But Lisa's able to get the rest of the new Yasserin on side along with Rory, because it's not his name going down. And, you know, Lisa's flabbergasted and pretty pissed in her confessional, saying that she almost wished she did say it, but she didn't. And, you know, she's promptly kicked off at that final 12. But it's just something subtle as your word or your lack of word that can get you sent home.
Yeah, so this is really survivors trying to fill in the blanks and replace the vagueness with something that fits their agenda.
Exactly. And I mean, as long as you can have a conversation with someone and pick on something that they can say and then relay it to somebody else and then add in your mistruth, you know, they can't come along and say that they've never had that conversation with you, because then you can essentially blur the lines of what's truth and what's lies. And so really it's harder for that third party you're trying to explain it to see the woods for the trees and see who's telling the truth and who's lying. So it's great in a sense that, you know, you can really play this kind of you know, wordsmith
telephone game, so to speak.
Yeah, telephone game, yeah. So, you know, I was really fascinated by that, because I think they're, you know, going back to the what Russell was able to do with pinpointing on Danielle's weakness at that moment, where she's quite upset and she really, you know, she goes from strong to weak in that tribal council, and I feel like it doesn't get its due, so to speak, in that episode.
Stephen, you have taken us through all the different lies that Survivor players tell. Do you feel like, is there anything that you couldn't fit into any of these categories?
You know, sometimes with certain lies, they kind of, I had to try and figure out whether or not, like, let's say, for instance, Sandra with sugar gate incident, is that more of a reactive lie, or can I shoehorn that into stealing? And really, if it, you know, it's something you could go into either one. But I just found it difficult to, in some aspects, put one lie in one section when it could have been in another. More so than, as you just mentioned, whether or not there was a lie that I couldn't fit into any of these categories.
Thank you so much for taking us through all this. Do you have a hashtag for today?
Oh my. Shapira red flag is okay. One.
Let's go with that. The Shapira red flag. Is it Shapira or Shapira? What should we say?
I feel like it could be Shapira, but I mean, because we're, you know,
who knows? Who knows? It's too long. I don't even remember. That's how long it's been. All right. So the Shapira red flag. And so, Stephen, I really appreciate all the hard work you put into this. If people want to follow you on social media, how can they get a hold of you?
You know what? I you know, besides sucking at lying, I suck at social media a lot more. I used to be on Twitter a long time ago, then I stopped because I was like, what the hell am I doing? But yeah, no, I do have a dormant or undormant Twitter account, which I'll, you know, use to, if anyone wants to, you know, send hate my way or ask any questions. Yeah, my Twitter handle is O D Callahan, so O for Oscar, D for Delta. and then my surname, Callahan.
Okay, yeah, dust it off. Dust it off to get all of this feedback from this show. Again, great work going through everything, all these different lies, and then we'll see if there are any new ones to add this fall.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, Rob. I mean, it was a really great exercise to go back through and just watch all of these survivalist lies, and I hope if anyone can make any sense of what I was saying and can take anything away from it, you know, more power to them and trying to expose the liars and survival.
All right. Well, great work. We got a very busy week coming up the rest of the week. I will be back with News AF with Danny and Tyson, and then we are going to be kicking off our Big Brother coverage Wednesday night and Thursday night. We will be live back to back those nights. Plus, we'll have a show on Friday where we talk about the first 12 hours or so of the Big Brother live feeds coming up later on this week. So make sure you don't miss any of that when you subscribe. Rob has a website .com/iTunes. Of course, canvaspeople.com is our sponsor today. If you want to get that special $0 pricing on an 11x14 canvas photo, do that with promo code RHAP. And to see offers from all of our sponsors, you can visit us anytime at robhasawebsite.com/offers. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.